Welcome to the Halderman Podcast. I'm your host, Robert McNamara, and today we will be speaking about agriculture in the Ukraine. I'm joined by Dr. Alan Lines, retired professor of The Ohio State University and current agricultural consultant domestically and internationally. Thanks, Alan, for joining us today.
Well, I just am glad to be here. Really.
I'm glad you accepted. And if you would, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, it's a situation. I'm not a Buckeye by birth. I was raised on a very, at that time, small, diversified farm in Western New York, about halfway between Buffalo, New York, and Erie, Pennsylvania, in the plain area where there's a lot of grapes grown. But our farm was located kind of on a hillside, and it was a mix of everything from apple trees to grapevines to, you know, hay fields, wheat fields, and working along with the neighbors because the farm was only about 50 acres. And so we didn't have a lot of equipment. But growing up in that area, we're ready to get out of high school. And what was my expectation? I was going to go be a farm laborer on some larger farm. But, you know, one of my teachers kind of said to me, "Alan, what are you going to do after graduation?" I said, "Well, I guess I'm going to work on a farm." And he said, "Well, why don't you go to college?" And I said, "My goodness, our family's never been to college. We don't have the money to do so." And he said, "You could borrow money." And I said, "Oh, you can't borrow money to go to college." And sure enough, a local bank funded me to get started. Fall of 1959, I left the farm and went to Cornell University, graduated there. And then after that, taught high school vocational agriculture for 5 years, went back to get a master's degree. And in the meantime, I had been married and had some children. And my wife said, "Okay, let's go." So it wouldn't have been for her saying okay, I never would have gone. And so finished up my master's degree at Cornell and then off to Purdue to get my PhD. In 1973, finishing up at Purdue, I felt that I had had enough theoretical education. And I really appreciated all that education. But I decided I needed to get back and get a little bit of mud on my shoes. So I went out and managed a farm for a year and a half, and then came to Ohio State in the summer of 1974. And I really worked there from 1974 until I retired, finishing up there. And it was right at the time that the Soviet Union kind of broke up. And I decided that I needed to know something about that old Soviet Union. So I started to work with the USDA and some of the programs that they had, sending me overseas trying to learn a little bit about what's going on there in that Soviet Union. So that's kind of what eventually led me into Ukraine.
Well, you've had quite a journey.
I have, and much appreciative of it.
Yeah, it's got to be a little bit different coming from an area where you grew multiple different crops to come to the Midwest, where it's basically corn, soybeans, and wheat here in Ohio and Indiana, and a little bit of alfalfa sprinkled in, but you have a wide variety of experience.
Well, the reason that, you know, leaving the Northeast and then coming to Purdue, the reason behind that really was because in my education at Cornell, it was at that time when something coming on the scene was called the computer. And believe it or not, Cornell was behind the scene and Purdue was the leader. And that's why I ended up going to Purdue, so that I could learn something about using the computer for more efficient farm management purposes.
That's great. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your traveling and your time in Ukraine?
Well, my first visit over there was in 1993, and I'll tell you, that was after the Soviet Union had broken up, of course, and before I was in Ukraine working. I had worked with USDA in Poland and in Bulgaria, which were both under the old Soviet system. And what I had seen in all three of those countries was an agriculture that was not performing according to our Western learning and what we were capable of, what farmers were capable of doing here in the U.S. And so I looked at that and I really felt that I needed to learn more about it. When I first went into those countries, and Ukraine was, you know, there at the number three country that I had really worked in, what I found was farmers that really had no idea about the difference between profit and loss. There was no connection between what they were doing and what they could do. They were simply doing what the old Soviet system told them to do. I remember being on one farm, and the farmer, you know, he was now trying to be a private farmer, and he was going to go out and borrow $5 million to get started. So we went through all of the planning there on that farm, and I said, are you sure that you want to borrow that money, and can you do it, really? He said, well, the government will probably lend it to me or give it. He said, give it to me, because that was the way it was. They didn't have to pay back their loans if they grew what the government told them to grow. So he said, I can do that. And I said, are you sure? And we went through all. But that was just a very clear example that they didn't understand private business. And I remember going, you know, particularly in Ukraine, in the first visit I had there, we went out, there was this young farmer in the village from the old state farm. And he was simply doing a super job in transitioning from the old system. And he had about, you know, maybe two cows and maybe 15 acres of ground or something like that. And he was selling his milk. And he was doing a great job. And then, you know, I went back to that same farm 2 years later, and he had grown to three to five cows. And I went back a year later to the same farm, and we made the appointment. And sure enough, I drove in and I said, what's going on here? So we talked to the farmer, and I said, what went on? And he said, well, my neighbors all burnt my buildings down and killed my cows. And I said, your neighbors that you grew up with? And he said, yes. And I said, what's going on? And he said, well, the community got together and said to me, don't you know that we are all supposed to be equal? That's the old system in their mind, see. And they had said, you're getting out of line. You're not equal to us. You're earning more money. And we decided you needed to be equal to the rest of us the way it always should be. That was the mentality of farmers that were coming out of that old Soviet system. You just couldn't believe it.
That is hard to believe, especially being in America.
It's real, I'll tell you.
And that mentality just got forced upon them. And then how long does it take to get out of that mentality if it's all you've ever known?
Yeah. And they were all part of in Ukraine and in the other Soviet countries. They basically had these two kinds of big farms. They were called sohos or kohos in the language. The sohos was a state owned farm operated by management in the offices of the capital city, telling people what to do. Didn't own anything. On the kohos, that was called a cooperative farm, where the people in the village actually owned what was there. But in effect, they were both the same. They just waited for directions from above in terms of what to plant, when to plant, and those kinds of things. So that it just was so unbelievable to somebody that, you know, didn't, you know, coming from the U.S. and the Midwest at that point and seeing they just don't understand in terms of what they're trying to do. They knew that there was something, but they just couldn't put it all together. What I could read and understand, there was such capability there that, you know, when I would come back from a visit, early visits to Ukraine, I would talk to farmers here in Ohio, and I'd say, well, give those farmers 10 years and they'll be knocking on your door with their exports once they learn what they can do. And every time I would go over, I would add 10 years to that dimension. And I don't know where it is now, because capabilities are still there, the potential still there, but it's not being realized. In fact, you know, like you look at Ukraine, its current corn yields are what we were 30 years ago or more, you know, 125 bushels to the acre, but they have the potential to do more. They have a long way to go yet in terms of realizing the potential of that country. For the world, which the world really needs. Most of the information that you read and see, you can see that the world is in a food crisis and it's going to not go away soon.
Is that still the way the ownership is now? They're still state run, or is it more the individual farmers own the land?
Well, you've got to remember that up until last summer, farmland could not be sold in Ukraine. Initially, 1991, when they broke up, they allowed sales of farmland. Government immediately saw, whoa, we got to stop this because all those Europeans and Americans are over here buying up this valuable farmland, and that's our nation's greatest asset. So they shut off. And I think 1992 or something like that, 93, I'm not sure that year, but they said, okay, no longer can farmland be sold. So people were given plots of land. For example, if you lived in one of these old kohoses or sohos, you were given maybe something in the neighborhood of 10, depending upon the quality of land. An individual family was given something like 10 to 25 acres of land as their farm, which might be in the middle of a field that was 2,000 acres, but that was their farm, plus the little farm near where they lived, their garden space. Up until last July, could not buy farmland. Nobody could buy farmland in Ukraine. But starting last July, July 21, they began to allow farmland to be sold, but foreigners could not buy farmland. And companies could not buy farmland. Only for the first few years, only individuals could buy farmland. And they were limited to, you know, maybe I forget the number, somewhere between 200 hectares of land that they could buy if they had the money. So most farmland was in these small, owned by the farmers. It was their land, but it was a small plot in these middle of these big fields. And so then people got together, a group of people called agro holding companies, and they would rent the land. And then individual farmers could rent the land. They could buy land, not legally, but they got it done. So we end up with most of that land, farmland, still being owned by individuals and being rented out to either private farmers or these agro-holding companies. And those are two different animals. And then you've got the family that might be operating their 25 acres or so. So it's still mostly individually owned smaller parcels in the country being rented out one way or another to a private farmer or an agri-holding company. So it's still a situation where most of that land is privately owned, but most of it is being rented out to these large agri-holding companies. And those companies put together very, very large pieces of property. For example, you know, probably the largest agri-holding company in Ukraine runs about 1.3 million acres of farmland. Big agri-holding company, it won't be all in one area. They might go out and rent all of the land that used to be one of these old state farms. So they operate it, manage it from an office somewhere in Capital City. And this is all, of course, what's going on now. You don't know what's happening with Russia there. But it's still not a situation where there's not a lot of ability to buy farmland if you're one of these private farmers or an individual.
It's very interesting how recently that's changed, being just last July.
Yeah, just last July, the law was passed that farmland could be sold. That was just up until last July.
You talked about there are archaic farming practices. What are some of the key ones or the main differences between farming there in Ukraine versus here?
Well, I think one of the biggest differences are a lot of the size of fields. You can't believe some of the sizes of fields. You know, they could, you know, field might be 2,000 to 4,000 acres. And the other being, of course, the soils that are there that are big influence on Ukraine. Private farmers and those agri-holding companies are pretty well equipped now, but not 20, 30 years ago. And they gradually grew. And then so they've got good equipment. But I've been, you know, on farms back there when I first went over that they were just, you go into the village and there's just a pile of used farm equipment, old Russian equipment that was all broken down. And that was what equipment they had. But if you look at what's going on now through these larger companies, and these private farmers are well equipped with basically the same kind of technology that we have here in the U.S., and the soils that they operate on, of course, some of them are just the best in the world. And, you know, it's called a Chernozem soil. It's deep and black. And Ukraine has about 25% of the best soil in the world, highly sought after. And that's why all the Europeans, and that's why everybody's wanting to have a piece of it if they can get a hold of it. But they're, you know, the seeds, the big companies that we recognize here in the U.S. are there in full force in terms of seed genetics, fertility companies are there, the grain companies are there, ADM, Cargill, and the others are there to buy the product if they can get it produced. Those companies, of course, are the ones that in the past, of course, were exporting it, which Russia has stopped at this point for the most part. But they're pretty well equipped, and they do seek all kinds of consultants to come over. We have one guy that goes over here from Ohio. He just retired, Harold Waters, and he's invited over there over and over and over again, and many times in the same year, to impart to those private and agri-holding companies the technologies that they can implant. And the first one was getting them to stop plowing if they would and go to a no-till operation. And the farmers over there that go to his meetings literally think that he wears a crown on his head because he just imparts such good information to them that they can use.
So they're getting better. It's just taken 30 years.
Yep, that's right. Absolutely. You know, even, you know, like 20 years ago, 30 years ago, there was very little corn planted in this country, Ukraine. And the yields were very, very low because they just didn't know how to do it. They didn't take advantage of the differences in moisture. You got to remember that Ukraine is naturally a small grain country because of a moisture problem. And you got to think about Ukraine as being where it's located, and, you know, geographically, you see it on the map, but put it in Ukraine in your mind this way. From east to west, it would run from New York City to Chicago, and it would run from Lake Erie down into central, almost to DC, from north to south. But that's not what, if you just move that over there, that's what it kind of looks like. But in reality, if you take that piece of real estate and you move it west, say, eastern, you know, Route 71, if that was the eastern end of Ukraine, the western end of Ukraine would be about 100 miles into Nebraska. But that's not the critical thing, because then you have to move that piece of real estate in your mind from that dimension, from eastern Ohio to Nebraska, now move it so that most of Ukraine sits in Canada. So it's kind of a situation where you're going to have a higher latitude, which really controls the weather, as you know, and the rainfall in many cases. So it's a very, very unique place, and it has a lot of potential yet in terms of what it really can do in terms of producing crop and getting it out.
Yeah, and then you talked about ADM being there and some of the grain buyers. One of the things we always hear about South America is they have infrastructure issues and trouble getting their crops to the grain elevators. Is that the case in the Ukraine, or what's their infrastructure like?
Well, up until this mess with the Russians, they had very good roads, and they had a major river coming down the middle of the country with lots of small ports where they could move that grain to the river and then on down the river to the Black Sea. They had good rail, good roads, good water, nothing like the problems that Brazil was having. So don't think of it in that fashion. Think of it in terms of they were used to almost the same kind of thing that we would have here in the U.S. Good roads, good rail, good water.
We talked about Ukraine.
But that's all changed now with the Russians. So keep that in mind.
Right. We talked about their exporters. You know, they're number three exporter in wheat, number four exporter in corn. Maybe you could explain to people how most of those crops get to the world market through the Black Sea.
Well, they did.
They did.
You got to remember that whole that southern coast of Ukraine on the Black Sea has 18 major seaport outlets for all of that grain and stuff coming in to Ukraine. 18, very, very good ports, but not. That's all changed now because Russia. People say they've cut off the Black Sea, but they haven't cut off the whole Black Sea. They have cut off the territorial waters of Ukraine, not the whole Black Sea. Keep that in mind. So things can get out through the Bosphorus area and the Dardanelles, but nothing can get out. Nothing really can get out of Ukraine because Russia has the territorial waters of the Black Sea of Ukraine under control. But that was, the logistics were really pretty good because that was all, a lot of that was built by Western firms so that they could get in there to get that product out and to get it to other places in the world. And one of the problems in terms of, not the Black Sea, but the rails went from Ukraine into Poland and then into Europe, the rest of Europe. But keep in mind, at the border of most of these old Soviet countries, there's a gauge change for the rail between Ukraine and Poland. So if you got a train load of grain coming in, going from Ukraine into Poland, when you hit the border, the gauge of the rail changes. So you got to take all the grain that's on that train, move it to another gauge underneath it of rail wheels before you can move it on. So you can get some out of there, but not a lot. And the other route is down, you go down through the south, way southwest in terms of Ukraine, up against Moldova and that area. And there's access to taken down there by rail, if the rails are still there, and you can put it on a boat there and then move it up the Danube and then out through the Black Sea. But that's a very slow and not a lot of moving. It's just the Black Sea is critical, no question about it. And that's why you end up in current news, why they're blowing up Mariupol. And they've taken other small ports out too to stop the movement of goods, because they know that Ukraine depends on itself, on the value of those products, and the rest of the world does too. But people need to also remember that it's not just the Black Sea. There's an area up in, say it would be the northeast corner of the Black Sea called the Sea of Azov, A-Z-O-V. And that has a lot of ports in there also. And Russia has basically closed those down also. So it's just closing that whole bottom side of Ukraine, the south side, in terms of moving things out through the Black Sea.
Well, that makes sense. I read an article yesterday that Ukraine had exported 1 million tons of corn last month, and I was trying to think how that was possible. I mean, it's a greatly reduced amount, so it makes sense that they had to find other ways to export it, and that's a very slow process.
Yeah, and you know, and what the result of that, of course, is that normally you'd expect in the bins in the country and in the grain aggregators, they would be moving grain into those and out of the country. And you would expect, the numbers that I'm looking at suggest that 2/3 and maybe even 3/4 of the grain that would have been exported out of Ukraine is still in the bins in Ukraine. And then that asks the question, if they do get a crop in the ground, which they will get some, and they do get it harvested, where are they going to store it if all of this year's grain is still in the bins? That's going to be a tough one.
That is going to be tough. That brings me to my next question. Have you spoken to anyone that's been in contact with anybody or in the Ukraine since the Russian invasion?
Oh, I've not talked on the phone, but we've talked by email with a very good private farmer in Ukraine. His name is, last name is Shuliak, and he operates about 2,000 acres of his own farm. And he also has a major custom farming operation, and he operates 15 to 20 combines on a custom harvesting, and he does some custom planting also. And what he tells me, and he just doesn't know what he can't buy the parts that he needs to get equipment repaired. And the people that he was using, hiring to run all of his equipment are now soldiers. And he has money in the bin, if you will, but he doesn't have money to buy whatever chemicals and fertilizers and seed that he didn't get bought before the Russians came in. So he's got a very, very good business, a very sharp man, and he's doing a good job. His son is now a freshman at Ohio State University. He just finished up his freshman year. And I have talked by email to a number of professors that studied here at Ohio State in the Ag Econ department with me and other people. And they are all safe. One of them has moved into Poland, but the others are still located through their universities, but may have moved out to villages where they're parents may live, but they're all safe, and we have been able to send some money over to them to help them out with what they need in terms of buying items to facilitate and help the soldiers stay alive with food and clothing and protection and those kinds of things. So it's people are telling us that things are tough, and you can watch TV and see it yourself.
Yeah, it's really just a terrible situation.
Yeah.
Based on people that you've talked to and what you know, do you have an expectation of what percentage of the crop you think that they'll be able to get planted?
Well, the Ag Ministry of Ukraine says that they think that maybe 80% of the crop will get in the ground. I doubt that, because now the Russians are blowing up the farm fields, leaving landmines in these farm fields. So I'll be surprised if the Ministry of Ag's numbers, and they say 80% might get in the ground. But along with that, you can see that the yields will be down. So the product that comes out will be produced. I'm thinking that somewhere in that, 50 to 75% of what usually is produced might get produced this year. Farmers are wearing, armor, military gear out in the field to protect themselves from being shot. Helmets and breastplates and all those things. So it's hard to tell what it'll be, but I'll be surprised if we don't see a major reduction in the crop that's produced in Ukraine this year. And it's likely to go on for another year in the same. The Russians left today, that would not say things are back to normal, because it would be a long time before that whole agricultural sector gets back in gear, if they can.
Yeah, and like you said, even if they do grow crop, where are they going to store it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, just really, when you stop and say, these bins are still full of this year's crop. The last number that I saw said that normally there would be about 5 million tons left in the country. And now there's about 20 million tons stored in the country. And Russia's seeing that, and Russia is stealing that grain, moving it into Russia, or moving it to Crimea, which they control completely. And then in addition to that, they are bombing major agricultural businesses, really disrupt the whole agricultural sector.
Yeah, it's hard to even imagine, put yourself in their shoes with what they're going through.
That's for sure.
Is there any other information you'd like to share with us today about the Ukraine?
Well, I think that one of the things, I think that when I first learned about Ukraine in the high school world history, and even later on, we used the term the Ukraine. We never called it Ukraine. It was always called the Ukraine. And I asked myself why. And that was because most of my life, Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union. And they looked upon Ukraine as a place to produce food, all kinds of food, fruits and vegetables and grains, things that you've mentioned. And the came around in our language because you and I use the term the Corn Belt as kind of a breadbasket of the U.S., the Corn Belt. And so we said the Ukraine being part of the Soviet Union. And we've got to get away from dropping that preposition there, in terms of the, and just call it Ukraine. It is not the Ukraine, it is Ukraine. Not the Ukraine. And we've got to keep that in mind, that comes back from the old Soviet system. And the people there that I've watched over the years that I've been there, and I don't know how many times I've been there. The last time I was there was the fall of 2020 with an agribusinessman from here in Ohio that wanted to do business in Ukraine. And he wanted me to go over with him. I said, all you would have to do is pay my expenses. I don't want any consulting fee or anything like that. He said, the reason I want you to go is because I want you to listen to every one of my conversations with farmers. And then you and I will talk afterwards and make sure that you and I heard the same thing, because they're going to be, a lot of them be speaking in broken English and some Ukrainian, and some of them would even be speaking a little Russian. So it's a fantastic place. It has a major history, and it has a bright future for it if we can assist the Ukrainians in coming out of the control of, if you will, Russia per se. It's a fantastic place, and I really want to emphasize the soil. And if you were to take a farmer from the best soil in Illinois or Iowa, wherever it might be, or even here in Ohio, and you would take them over there and show them this, what they call best Chernozem soil in the world, they would probably have tears in their eyes. It's that good. That's all I can say.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today and all the valuable information. It's been very enlightening for me personally, and I'm sure the listeners will agree.
Well, I'm sorry I took so long, but once I get started, it's hard to stop.
This has been great. Thank you so much for all the good info. If you'd like to contact Dr. Lyons about his consulting services, his contact info could be found at the university website. Also, if you'd like to hear more of the Halderman podcast, they can be found at halderman.com. Thank you.